Hey.
Blog Talk Radio.
And thanks for Blog Talk Radio, our platform. This is Quest Youth Radio, the best youth radio. Quest Community Vibration, which is something that we do from the campus of Seton Hall. But right now, this very day, it's Blog Talk Radio. And we trust that you're ready and tuned in. Now, if you missed the show when it's live, and we're live right now, you'll probably be able to catch it on the rebroadcast, all right? And so that's the great thing. Now, we have our student host, Walter Pierce, who'll be chiming in momentarily. And we also have our confidant, our man in charge of history and documentation and archives, Mr. Shelton Harris, who is a personal friend of mine for a very long time. And I have to, with all transparency being clear, one of the things that we have in common is history and the understanding of the plight of American black people in this country. Mr. Harris, are you there, by the way? Or is that Walter?
Well, this is Walter.
Okay. This is Walter. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the show. So I guess for what we have on tap for today, we're going to be covering a definition. We're also going to be covering over an article that talks about the digital divide. And we're also going to be talking about none other than the African-American historian, John Hendrick Clark.
Okay. Now, I'm going to jump in right here to say that we just lost John Lewis yesterday. And
yes.
John Lewis had been on the forefront, a pioneer in the fight against inequality and the things that we pretty much discuss in our programming daily. It is his shoulders that we stand on when we talk about change is going to come. It is his shoulders that we stand on when we talk about protest nonviolently and demonstrating. It is his shoulders that we stand on when we talk about making a change legislatively by becoming part of the political apparatus that governs this country. He went from the street to the halls of Congress to make a difference for black people in America. And that is my tribute to John Lewis this morning. And Walter, I hand it back over to you.
Yes, again, rest in peace, John Lewis. I've seen a movie on him. On the movie Selma, you know, he was portrayed in there as a young, inspiring college student who just wanted to go out, march with Dr. King, and just make a change in the world. And I just respect that as a young person being out there, being beaten by police, and still being willing to go out there and fight for his freedom. That's a lot of respect that he gained from me, and I just want to say again, rest in peace, John Lewis. But now we have to go into a diner. And Mr. Bay, you could read the intro, the diner.
Okay. Yeah, that's a problem. History is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of and the blood of our ancestors. Look deeply, and you're bound to find yourself. You see, everyone out there that's listening, diamonds provide an historical message that interprets what's happened and suggest what can happen by providing an historical analysis. Only by recognizing yesterday's mistakes can we make corrections today and build a better tomorrow for all our nights to come. Because no one knows the past better than those who have walked in it and bared its burden.
Yes, and to start, for John Henry Clark, born John Henry Clark on January 1st, 1915 in Union Springs, Alabama. John left the family farm in 1933 to Harlem, New York, during the period some historians refer to as the Great Migration. This period refers to the time during 1910 and 1970, where African Americans moved from southern states to the northern states in search of work and better quality of life. Arriving in Harlem at the age of 18 in 1933, Clark developed as a writer and lecturer during the Great Depression years, becoming a part of the movement we now understand as the Harlem Renaissance. Much of this development came through Clark becoming a member of several study circles, such as Harlem History Club and the Harlem Writers Workshop. However, a formal education was not something Clark completed, as he studied intermittently at New York University, Columbia University, Hunter College, the New School of Social Research, and the League for Professional Writers. In post-World War II era, there was a new artistic development, with small presses and magazines being founded and surviving for brief times. Writers and publishers continued to start new enterprises. Clark was the co-founder of the Harlem Quarterly, view editor of the Negro History Bulletin, associate editor of the magazine Freedom Ways, and a feature writer for the Black-owned Pittsburgh Courier. Clark taught at the New School for Social Research from 1956 to 1958, traveling in West Africa in 1958 to 1959. He met Kwame Nkrumah, who he had mentored as a student in the U.S., and offered a job working as a journalist for the Ghana Evening News. Clark, chairman of the Department of Black and Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College, a subsidiary, a city university of New York between 1969 and 1986. Additionally, Clark was named as the Carter G. Woodson Distinguished Visiting Professor of African History at Cornell. John Henry Clark's greatest period of influences resides in the 1960s, where he was a prominent intellectual during the Black Power movement, advocating on the African-American experience and the place of Africans in world history. He challenged the views of academic historians and helped shift the way African history was studied and taught. In one especially heated controversy, Clark edited and contributed to an essay attacking William Styron, an American novelist who wrote the novel The Confessions of Nat Turner. Besides teaching at Hunter College and Cornell University, Clark founded Black professional associations to support the study of Black culture. He was a founder with Leonard Jeffries and the first president of African Heritage Studies Association, which supported scholars in areas of history, culture, literature, and the arts. He was a founding member of the organization to support work in Black culture, the Black Academy of Arts and Letters, and the African American Scholars Council. Thank you.
Okay, so I have to ask you, what motivates you to talk about and read about John Henry Clark?
Well, to start off, you know, again, where every week we're trying to find a new area of African American history that we probably didn't expect, or we probably didn't know who. See, John Henry Clark, most people probably didn't know, he was the pioneer, or one of the first people to start a African studies program at college, and that really led to what we see now with a lot of programs, with a lot of even high schools starting to put it in to the curriculum, now starting to study African, and that's really important for us African Americans to know our history, because, you know, we're always taught the history of us in America and how tragic that was, but you know, we also had history in Africa because that's where we came from. So it's always good to be able to know our history, where we came from, and not just be limited to just the European history.
Okay. Good job. Now, I'm going to bring in Mr. Harris, but first I want to say this is my introduction to you, Walter, of John Henry Clark, so that you are now formally introduced to this African-American noted historian, so that you can read some of his books and find out even more. And I also, would say that to the audience as well. But you being the young person in the room,
right,
specifically for you, Walt. Mr. Harris, what is the significance of John Henry Clark to you?
For me, I really look at him. He's one of the heroes of mine, you know, because he really opened up the whole conversation about African history prior to the enslavement, which really interrupted a long legacy of positive things that went on in the continent and around the world for people of color. You know, he was really a very big force for me. And, you know, I bring up his name a lot. You know, and the fact that he taught in different universities and stuff, he opened up a lot of minds of a lot of people who were trying to do the same thing. You know, he and Leonard Jeffries were working in tandem over at Hunter University in CUNY to bring forth an understanding of what's really going on with our history and how we can do, and not necessarily how we can do, but what we've done and setting the blueprint for what we need to do in order to change ourselves back into the great people that we've always been.
Okay. All right. I was first introduced to John Henry Clark when I read the book titled From Slavery to Freedom. Is anybody familiar with that book?
Yes.
No.
Oh, well, From Slavery to Freedom was basically a book that tells the history of the African in Africa and how it leads all the way up to here in America. And so the missing part in history, as you very well know, Mr. Harris, that in America they like to talk about black history from slavery until now, but the history of the people starts in Africa. All right? And I
exactly.
think we talked about this Wednesday.
Right.
And one of the things that John Clark was really upset about at a lot of educational institutions in America was the fact that our history had been purposely eliminated, so that the only thing that we can be referred to in history books starts out as slaves, and that is not the true picture. Okay. Walter, I'm going to go back to you so we can continue the program. What do you have next?
Yes, and for the next, I would just like for the intro for definitions, please.
Absolutely. And this segment, titled Definition, provides the listener, that's you, with the words and their meaning so that we can achieve together a common basis to say that we care and believe in ourselves. Remember, whosoever controls our definition controls us. We must define our existence and not, hear me, not have it defined for us.
Yes, and the definition for today is a definition that we use a lot, overuse a lot on this show, and that is racism. Now, there's two definitions I like to read about racism, then I like to pose a question to Mr. Bay. But the definitions I have is prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed to someone or of a different race based on the belief that one's own race is superior. And the other one I have is the belief that all members of each race possesses characteristics or abilities specific to that race, especially so as to distinguish it as superior to another race or races. Now, a question I'd like to pose for everybody in the call, because I know me and Mr. Bay talked about this, and he explained it pretty well, so I like for him to explain it again. And that is, can black people be racist in America?
Okay. I'm going to shift over to Mr. Harris before I answer that question.
Right.
Shift over, because we have people on the line, right? We got 7035. We have 5071, and we have 6778. But Mr. Harris, I want you to chime in, right? And everybody, I'm going to ask you, can a black people, your question was, can a black person be racist?
Yes.
Okay. You heard the question, Mr. Harris?
Yes, I did. And personally, I think the answer to that is no. Because racism has not as much to do with the actual color of a person, but who happens to be in power at the time. Now, if in order for a black person to be, you know, well, Paul Mooney once said, if I said that I hated white people and I just stood out on the corner and screamed that every day, I can't stand white people and I want to do all kinds of things to them, does that make me racist? He said no, because nothing I said is going to change where a person is going to be able to live, whether they're going to be able to get a loan, a business loan from the bank, whether their kids are going to have the proper education. That's where racism really comes in. It's a power game where if you're in charge, you can stop people from doing other stuff. Black people have never been in a position to stop white people from doing anything in this country. So just by the definition of the word, then, no, we cannot be racist.
All right, Mr. Harris, I'm going to come back to you. We're going to continue this discussion in just a second. I want to go to, first of all, I'd like for you to good morning. Please introduce yourself with the last four numbers, 7035.
Good morning, it's Valerie.
I kind of knew that. What do you think about racism? Can black people be racist?
Based on definition, I want to say no. But I did want to speak later on at the end of the show, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all. You know?
Okay.
You know how we do here. We're going to go. Thank you, Val, for introducing yourself, and we're going to definitely make sure we come back to you for around the end of the show. Whoever it is, 6778, please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Bay.
Good morning. Good morning. Who is this?
This is Calvin Pierce checking in.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
As usual, do you want to make a comment?
Other than still a great show, great commentary, keep up the great work, and God bless you.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to keep it going. Mr. Harris, I'm coming back to you. All right. You know, the systematic racism that has existed in America, right, where we have been told that there are situations where black people have actually been called racist, okay? We have a current situation that's going on where a guy just lost his show for saying anti-Semitic comments. Mind you, I have not done any research on the situation. I just know that the brother don't have a job with Viacom no more. Do you know what I'm talking about, Mr. Harris?
Yes, I do. And it wasn't because he was making up stuff, or he was just saying things that were true historically, but because the people in the powers that be didn't like the truth, that part of the truth to be exposed at this time. So this is why he really, that's what really got him in trouble. And he really didn't say anything that wasn't true. You know, because technically there's no such place as the Middle East, that part of Northern Africa. They wanted to separate it from Africa so that we can have these type of conversations now. But this is not, there's no such place as the Middle East. So this particular brother brought this situation up where that the original people from that area were African. And some people felt like, how could you say that when it's true, but we've been telling you a lie all this time? How you going to tell people the truth and expect us to still have you part of our system? It happens to a lot of our people. You know, as soon as we step out of our place, you know, so-called, and we start talking about things that are the truth that might hurt some people's feelings, but this is not about feelings. This is about exercising your right to speak the truth. And he got slapped down for that. And it's sad that, you know, that there's only a few outlets for us to have a conversation where we can tell the truth without being chastised for it.
Okay.
But yeah,
all right.
I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're gonna shift it back. Walter. You know, pretty much Mr. Harris answered your question for me. I'm of the thinking, unless you have control of another person's job, unless you can, stop a person from living in a particular area, which we call redlining, right, which you are familiar with. You know, you can deny jobs and resources, right? You can't be a racist. And black people, you know, cannot deny resources to anyone. Right. In fact, it's just the opposite. We fighting for resources. So, Walter, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And, you know, that was a lot. That was some really good points that was mentioned there. Talking about the biggest one, the socioeconomic status of African Americans, and how we're not the top of the chain considered by most people. How can somebody who's being oppressed be racist to another person? We can't stop anything that they're doing. We say something, how are you going to be affected by it? You're still going to be able to live your life, do what you got to do, still get the best quality things and all that, you know? And I'm just, that's one, like, it could be hate. I mean, I'll commit that at most, you know? Blacks could hate. But can't be racist because you're not destroying the race or anything.
Economically. So I'm gonna suggest that you use that for a transition to go into the next segment, which I would like to read the introduction for. Are you ready, Walter?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let Walter actually introduce what he's going to talk about, but I'm going to read the introduction, which is chains of events. You see, Walter's about to talk about things that are like an interpretation of news that affects the global community, specifically the African American and Latino diaspora, from the alloys of cities like Newark, East Orange, Chocolate City. A report on events in politics, education, law, business, religion, and science. Chains of events reveals the interpretation of one event to another so that you, the listener, will know what's happening. What's happening, Walter?
All right, what's happening? So we have something about is the digital divide. And just to read this article that I have here, before the late 20th century, digital divide referred chiefly to the division between those or without telephone access. After the late 1990s, the term began to use mainly to describe the split between those with or without internet access, particularly broadband. The digital divide typically exists between those in cities and those in rural areas, between the educated and the uneducated, between socioeconomic groups and globally, between the more and less industrial developed nations. Even among populations with some access to technology, the digital divide can be evident in the form of lower performance computers, lower speed wireless connections, lower price connections, such as dial-up and limited access to subscription-based content. The reality of a separate access marketplace is problematic because of the rise of services such as video on demand, video conferencing, and virtual classrooms, which require access to high-speed, high-quality connections that those of the less served side of the digital divide cannot access and or afford. And while adoption of smartphones is growing, even among lower income and minority groups, the rising cost of data plans and the difficulty of performing tasks and transactions on smartphones continue to inhibit the closing of the gap. According to recent studies and reports, the digital divide is very much a reality today. A June of 2013 U.S. White House broadband report, for example, showed that 71% of American homes have adopted broadband, a figure lower than other countries with comparable gross domestic product. Proponents for closing the digital divide include those who argue it would improve literacy, democracy, social mobility, economic equality, and economic growth.
Tell me, Walter, what does it all mean? What does it all mean? You just gave me recited.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, to sum this up, so, you know, before the 90s, you know, the real digital divide that really only exists was telephones, like who and who didn't have a telephone. After the 90s, you have different things introduced. You have internet, computers, all these different TVs, all types of technology that was introduced, and cell phones. And you know, you see it more in places like cities with urban and suburban areas, and it's lacking in areas of rural and lower income areas that, you know, probably don't have the best, the fastest, or the newest type of technology or internet speed. So the thing is, for today, that is we need it's the most important today because of the new era of now video conferencing and virtual classrooms, where you're going to need a good internet speed to be able to hold up a connection, to be able to clearly understand what is going on in the video conference. And if you don't, it's just going to be choppy. You're going to be lagging in and out, and you're not going to be able to successfully complete what you have to do. Now, what I think is, it is very expensive, and I've seen with the actually a lot of schools and a lot of places, actually they're trying to improve this by putting internet access automatically on computers. You know, you have different schools giving children laptops that don't have it, providing the internet access that they need to be able to complete their things. And they're trying to close that divide.
Gap.
That gap, I should say. Yeah, that gap. That's what they're trying to do. And, you know, they're improving at it, and we're not fully there. But I believe that at the rate we're going, I believe that we could get there.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, that's very good to hear from you. Mr. Harris, I'm going to call on you in a second. The digital divide is something that is very serious. I want to refer to the pandemic, and I want everybody to realize that this pandemic has exposed the bullet wounds that have been affecting disenfranchised people here in America for years. It wasn't until the pandemic that we realized that we had to have virtual classrooms, that everyone had to have internet access, and that it took political leadership to go out into the industry and say, listen, you have to provide internet access for everyone, because some of these children can't afford internet access. You know, the digital divide is bigger than what we're talking about. And because on one hand, the technology and understanding how to operate it is a divide within itself. So you can have the laptop, and the computer, but if you don't know how to utilize it, what good is it? And so, you know, it's exposed something that should have been part of the educational process all along. Mr. Harris, would you like to chime in on this?
Yes, because I've been in a couple classrooms recently, and a lot of times if a lot of people are using the internet at the same time, the servers in the schools can't handle all of the information, and they usually crash. But that's mainly in communities that don't have the resources to upgrade their stuff. Like a lot of people are still dealing with the hard line cable lines to get their internet access. Some people are dealing with the fiber optic, which is a lot quicker, but that's an upgrade. And all of these upgrades comes with a price tag. And depending on which community you're in, these price tags are either accessible or not accessible. Just like you were saying that you have some kids who don't have the proper internet. They have internet at their house, but in order to get the broadband, you have to pay extra in order to do all the other things, and that's just in school. If you were trying to do a business and your business called for you to be on the internet, they make you pay extra for the same services that you would get somewhere else. And this is just in the urban area. In the suburban areas and the rural areas, a lot of these people, I know in some places in the South, they don't have internet access at all if it's not Wi-Fi, because there's no hard line anything going around. A lot of these farms and a lot of these rural schools and houses, they don't have internet access. They don't have wires running that fiber optic running into their house, and it's all a matter of money, and money and access. So if your community has a greater access, good. You know, hey, because keep going.
Okay. That's all right, and thank you for allowing me to cut in. Right, I'm gonna swing over to Val because we're about to wrap up the show. Walter was afraid, believe it or not, Walter was afraid that we might not have enough content to cover the time. If you can believe that, Val, I would like for you. We're at the end of our show. I'd like for you to make whatever comments you feel free to. Put forth into our platform today.
Okay. I just wanted to do a very small tribute to Mr. John Lewis, who passed away. And it's from his book titled Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement. And in the book, there's this small paragraph towards the end in the chapter called Home. And it says, when I look back on my own life, and what I've come through, I can say that it was the prayers of the true believers, the prayers of an uninvolved community of similar minds that made it possible for me to still be here. Sometimes when I look back at the film footage of that civil rights fight and see what happened to me at Selma or on the Freedom Rides, I have to believe that it was the prayer of the faithful that made it possible for some of us to still be here. And, you know, just thanking and thanking him for his service and his dedication and his strength and, you know, for all that he did to help make life easier for us.
Well, you know what, Val? That makes it a bookend. As we started our program talking about John Lewis, we end our show. We continue to talk about the struggle. We place it up on the platform. We don't pretend to have all the answers and be able to solve all the problems. What we do, straightforwardly, continue to talk about and discuss them and bring it to the forefront. And I urge and encourage each and one of the listeners to do the research out here and find out on your own. And don't just be a follower. Learn to become a leader like John Henry Clark. Learn that there's a divide in this country. Learn that there's a double standard. And learn that the definition of words are not complete unless you know and created your own definition. And on that, that's a wrap for this today's show. Walter, I'll get you to have the last word here quickly.
Everybody, I just want to thank everybody for tuning in today. You know, it was a very informative show, and rest in peace to John Lewis.
Okay, then that's going to be a wrap. Everybody, Quest Youth Radio is the best.
The best youth radio.
You better believe it. Until Wednesday night, we'll see you. Thank you, everyone, for participating and calling in. And until next week, we'll see you. Peace.